Mr. Chairman, Bangisa, and friends. As you've just heard, in these 8 lectures, we're concerned with a subject of very great importance. We're concerned with transformation of life and transformation of world in the Sutra of Golden Light. And as we've also heard, as we've also been reminded, we're now already halfway through the whole series. And in the course of the last 4 weeks, we have covered quite a lot of ground. In the first lecture, we studied the growth of a Mahayana Sutra. Studied, that is to say, the growth, the evolution, the gradual development, as a literary document at least, of the Sutra of Golden Light. And we saw that it had, as it were, emerged over a period of some 300 years. From the 5th century AD to the 8th century AD. And we saw that it had emerged from the vast floating mass of oral tradition which was current in those days. Oral tradition stemming, oral tradition descending ultimately from the Buddha's own teaching. The original nucleus, we saw, of the Sutra of Golden Light is chapter 3 of the existing text, the existing version, the chapter which is called the Chapter of Confession. And this chapter, the Chapter of Confession, as we saw in this first lecture, is the center of energy, as it were, of the entire sutra. And this chapter, this center of energy, attracted from the oral tradition the 18 other chapters that make up the work in its final form. In the second lecture, we immersed ourselves in the Bodhisattva's dream. We allowed ourselves, as it were, to go to sleep and to dream, a very beautiful dream. The Bodhisattva's dream. And the Bodhisattva in question was, of course, Ruchiraketu. And his dream, the dream which he has in chapter 3 of the sutra, his dream was the result of a problem with which he'd been struggling. The problem, as it was to him, of why the Buddha had such a short life. Now, Ruchiraketu has seen the answer to this problem, but he's not been able, in the sutra, as yet, to assimilate that answer fully. And in the dream which he has, he sees a golden drum shining like the sun. He sees Buddhas everywhere. All sitting under jewel trees, and he sees a man in the form of a Brahmin beating on a drum. And while that Brahmin is beating on the drum, there come forth confessional verses. In the third lecture, we examined the spiritual significance of confession. We saw that confession is the very ancient Buddhist practice, going back to the earliest times, going back to the days of the Buddha himself. We saw that it's common to all schools, common both to monks and to lay people. And we saw furthermore that confession was not just a verbal acknowledgement of something that you'd done, or even something that you'd thought. Confession, we saw, real confession, genuine confession, was a profound spiritual experience. It was a sort of vomiting up of the evil that is within one. We further saw in that third lecture, that it's the individual who confesses. That one confesses as an individual, not as the member of a group. And one confesses to other individuals. One confesses to Buddhas and to Bodhisattvas. More concretely, one confesses to the spiritual community. And one confesses everything. One holds nothing back. One is completely open. Not only that, one confesses as soon as possible. In fact, one keeps up a continual confession. Confession, in fact, is an integral part of spiritual life and spiritual practice. And above all, perhaps, and this was something that seems to strike a very sympathetic chord in the hearts and minds of quite a number of people, one confesses without any feeling of guilt. In fact, we saw that unless one is free from feelings of guilt, one cannot, in fact, truly and genuinely confess. In the fourth lecture, we looked at the protectors of the Dharma. And these protectors are, of course, the four great kings. The four great kings who, in chapter 6 of the sutra, come forward and promise to protect the sutra. We saw that they occupy the lowest of the six heavens of the plane of sensuous desire. They keep under control all the different classes of non-human beings. And they represent the forces of balance and harmony in the cosmos. We also saw that they submit themselves to the Dharma, submit themselves to the golden light, are receptive to the golden light. Therefore, they represent the principle of spiritual hierarchy, the extremely important principle of spiritual hierarchy. They, the four great kings, accept the sovereignty of the transcendental energies that are above them, and they exercise sovereignty over the earthly energies that are below them. Now, in the course of the first four lectures, we also touched, rather more incidentally, on quite a number of other topics. We saw, for instance, what the Mahayana is. We saw what a sutra is. Something was said about the significance of the dream state. Also, emphasis was placed on the fact that if we want to develop spiritually, if we want to be transformed, then we must be ready to die. We also looked into the significance of the difference between the psychological, the spiritual, and the transcendental. We examined briefly the characteristics of the true individual. And also we came to know how the ancient Buddhists saw the universe. We understood the importance of giving. We learned what a temple is. And we even learned how to recognize dragons.